The Daily Connect podcast, the voice of the RNIB Connect community.
Welcome to the Daily Connect podcast for Thursday, the 23rd of August. A great show today as we will be talking about train travel and an organisation in Bedfordshire who are campaigning for better accessibility in stations, ticket machines and a lack of fully trained staff. But how bad is transport for blind and partially sighted people? We sought the views of RNIB Connect Radio listeners about all forms of transport and you'll hear their views today. Now joining me for the news review on the podcast today are actress and stand-up comedian Georgie Morrell and host of the afternoon edition Simon Pawley. We'll be addressing stories affecting the blind and partially sighted community, including a misplaced joke, a lawsuit, and accessibility at the fringe. Also today we'll meet Rachel, who tells us about how she sees as someone with retinitis pigmentosa. And our Society of the Week is the Beacon Centre in the Black Country. We'll be hearing what it offers and why it's so well renowned.
The Daily Connect podcast.
So before all that, a continuing issue for blind and partially sighted people remains train travel. It's not just getting from A to B, it's all the points in between, including station accessibility, ticket machines and a lack of fully trained staff. There's a disability campaign running throughout Bedfordshire to address some of these issues and fight for better access for everybody. Let's hear how bad things are at the moment.
I travel by train 3 days a week for work, and I also travel perhaps once or twice a week for leisure as well. And I'm finding the main difficulties at my local railway station at Biggleswade is buying a ticket. Only one of the platforms has got the tactile markings. The stairs are very, very steep and they don't have very good handrails. And the staff presence is quite inconsistent. And of course, when there are no staff around, even in the ticket office or on the platforms, the ticket machines are completely inaccessible. And we do have a penalty fare system running on our line. So you're running the gauntlet of having a possible confrontation when you're trying to explain why you haven't got a ticket. It hasn't happened yet, but I can see that it is going to happen at some point in the future. And when I'm on the trains, I do rely on the audio announcements, which sometimes are not working. And they're also quite an assurance at the station that your train is arriving. Ours has been out of action for 4 months now, so thankfully they started working this morning, which is a great relief. I've joined a wider disability campaign that's being run throughout Bedfordshire to try and campaign for better access for everybody. And that's people who are wheelchair users, other disabilities and impairments. And I found that really useful, bringing to their attention the issues that we specifically face, which often get overlooked. In conjunction with this campaign, an event was organised at Biggleswade Railway Station, which attracted quite a few people. There was local media and it attracted quite a lot of attention from commuters. We were asking people to sign an online petition, which has been very successful. We had the Labour candidate in our constituency, North East Bedfordshire. We also had the Shadow Minister for Transport, Andy MacDonald, and the Rail Minister, who made their way up from London to come and see for themselves the inadequacies of the situation. The station is not just VI unfriendly at times. It's impossible to access for people who are wheelchair users or have got large cases or buggies for children. And we've been campaigning on and off now for a very, very long time. And during that time, the passenger usage has increased to about 1 million a year. It's a major commuter station for the town and the surrounding area. To highlight access problems at the event, we had the opportunity to speak to the shadow ministers to express concerns that I particularly had about buying a ticket and the potential loss of further hours to the booking office opening. And what do I do? What are the processes in place to buy a ticket when I can't get one from the booking office? You know, is it okay to buy one from anybody that challenges me on board the train, or am I expected to buy it at my destination? We also had representatives there from the rail company, the accessibility manager, and also their projects manager as well. And it was good to have the opportunity to have them listen to specific concerns that I have. along with the other wider concerns which others are able to voice as well. I've now been invited to a meeting which includes our Member of Parliament, some people from the local authority, the rail companies and Network Rail, to try and explore ways of getting funding to get our station redesigned and made accessible. I think because of the length of time we've been campaigning now on and off and about the need for station access improvements, I think they were quite embarrassed to see the state of the station now and the fact that it isn't really fit for purpose for anybody, let alone people with disabilities. What I would say to anyone else who's visually impaired who is having similar issues to myself or has problems with, you know, regular problems with travel, is to bring it to the attention of the rail company. Do complain. Don't let them fob you off with a standard response. Do follow up on it. And do get in touch with your local regional campaigns coordinator who can support you through the process and maybe help you to talk to the right people at the rail company, because that can often make an enormous difference. Or even get your local council or your MP involved.
Stay with the Daily Connect podcast as we have the views of listeners who have had good and bad experiences of train travel coming up next. But first of all, do get in touch with us here at RNIB Connect Radio's Daily Connect. We want to hear your views on travel and train travel experience. You can get in touch via email radio@rnib.org.uk or on our social media channels, Twitter @RNIB Radio, or find us on Facebook, search RNIB Connect Radio.
The Daily Connect podcast.
So we've heard how a disability campaign in Bedfordshire is fighting for better train travel for blind and partially sighted people. But how bad is public transport? We asked some RNIB Connect Radio listeners to give us their views on public transport.
I use public transport every day. I work in London, so I commute. I'd say that it's got easier to use public transport independently in London over the past 10 or so years, simply because more forms of it talk. So you have stop announcements on buses. I think all the tube lines talk now, whereas probably about half of them did when I first moved to London about 15 years ago. I've long since abandoned asking bus drivers where the stops are. Fortunately, the talking announcements by and large render that redundant, particularly when paired with the GPS app, and I abandoned it largely because I've had, you know, some of the experiences that others have had, which is that, you know, people sometimes forget, and so now that buses talk, I'm taking them more often than perhaps I used to. One problem I wish they'd solve in London particularly is that multiple buses tend to stop at a single bus stop, and sometimes they'll stack one behind another, and other than the lead bus you won't always know what's in behind it. Sometimes the driver of a second or third bus will stop again, but sometimes they'll go barreling past. You know, you can ask, obviously, or get those cards and hold the number up. And sometimes you can use the travel apps to guess whether a bus may or may not be in behind if you sort of look at when they're due to stop. But neither of them are perfect, or none of those are perfect solutions. But it would be good if they sorted that out.
I use a lot of transport here in London, because public transport, that is, because I'm blind, I'm a guide dog user, and as a piano tuner, my job means I have to get to the customers. They can't bring their pianos to me. What I'd like to say is that things have massively improved over the last 30 years, especially on the London Underground. They're much more blind aware, they're much more helpful. I do worry a little bit about sometimes there's not much staff around, or many staff around, but generally when you're travelling the Underground, the help is great these days. Not quite so good on the trains. They do their best. But again, this is all reference to London, because London Bridge has been completely rebuilt by stages. So I've never asked for so much help before, because there's no point in training a dog to go from a platform to another platform at London Bridge at the moment, because sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not. Bridges disappear, escalators are being put in. So that's just constantly changing. So I'm always try and get help if I can't avoid London Bridge. The other thing is buses. London buses talk. That's fantastic. I will say that the odd bus driver will go past me at the bus stop. I expect they think, well, I didn't put my hand out. We do get request stops still. And they shoot past. Very annoying, but it happens sometimes. Another times buses turn up and the drivers shout out what numbers they are. So, you know, it's a mixed bag of help and sometimes not help. Also, with public transport now, the apps on the smartphones are great. The London Bus app I use here, and the train times for the trains gives me live updates on all the times. That's really help. And that's sometimes how I know that the bus just went past my bus stop, was the one I was waiting for. A couple of other things, I suppose, not quite so good. The electric, the hybrids, aren't they? Electric diesel buses. They can come and go without me knowing. I've actually missed my bus because I didn't hear it arrive. Because the background traffic noise is very loud. And also, I nearly got caught by one of them coming out of a bus garage because I simply didn't hear it. It was just on electric as they start to move away, and I didn't hear it coming. A little bit worried about that side of things in years to come. But generally, it's a thumbs up for most of the public transport. The technical improvements, you know, like announcements on the buses, is great. Even today, when I was coming back from Hammersmith, I noticed that they're starting to say what the next station is way before you get to the next underground stop. So you actually hear it announced twice, which is great because they're noisy environment. So my experience is getting has not always been good, but it's got better as a guide dog user, because that's very important. You know, you do need help. You don't want people to be frightened of your dog, and this blindness awareness that they've been obviously training their staff has really sort of paid off. So hats off.
Hi, I use public transport every day. I have to catch two buses into work. I live in Newcastle, Staffordshire, and I actually work in Stoke-on-Trent. So it's a two bus journey to get into work. And I dread that part. It's worse than going and walking somewhere and actually getting lost. I think that the drivers on the bus are not disability aware. I hate it when you're actually standing at a bus station and perhaps more than one bus may pull up at that stand. And nobody, the driver doesn't, even though they see you with a guide dog, they don't get off the bus and actually say to you, do you want to catch number blah blah bus, so that you can actually say yes or no. So you're there standing hearing the bus's approach and thinking to yourself, is this my bus or is it not? Now, if you're standing by a post as well, say where rather than a stand, sometimes there's like these posts with the sign above it that says bus stop, and perhaps several buses stop at that stop, again it's the same problem. The drivers will see you at the stop. This is the drivers in Stoke-on-Trent anyway. They will see you at the stop and they won't bother to shout, or not all of them actually, I'm being unfair, but most of them do not stand, do not get off the bus and say, you know, is this your, do you want this bus, to give you the option. So you're standing there feeling very vulnerable at that time. And if it wasn't for the general public actually coming and asking which bus you want and whether you need help, if it wasn't for the general public, I think that my journey would be a hell of a lot harder than it is, and it's hard enough as it is. But I think actually that there should be more focus upon training these bus drivers to look out for what visually impaired people need, and then people like us wouldn't be so dependent upon the general public if the bus drivers were doing their job properly. That's just my opinion.
I think the fact that in this country there are assistance and aid available for those with disabilities and other impairments who wish to travel around is a great thing and should be celebrated. However, the system is far from perfect and does require a lot of improvement. The fact that employee numbers are being cut in London doesn't help those travellers who have a disability and a visual impairment, because most often they are disadvantaged when they are compared with other travellers, because they often have to wait around for assistance. Sometimes communications breakdown leads to no assistance. Also, the fact that many platforms now do not have a tactile line to indicate to someone with a visual impairment that they are approaching the edge of the platform is disappointing. However, I hope that complaints will be taken seriously and campaigners will pick up on these facts and push for further improvements.
The Daily Connect podcast.
It's time for our news review, where we highlight some of the stories affecting the blind and partially sighted community. Join me to go through three stories that have made an impact this week. I'm very pleased to welcome partially sighted actress and stand-up comedian Georgie Morrell and host of the Afternoon Edition and musician Simon Polly. Welcome to you both. Hello.
Hi. Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Now, I raised both of your performance careers there as they are relevant to our stories this week, where we'll be discussing venue accessibility and the lawsuit being brought against Apple. But we're starting our news review today with a bit of bother RNIB found themselves in last week. During National Tell a Joke Day, RNIB posted a joke on Twitter about blind people. Then there was a barrage of complaints, so RNIB deleted the tweet and apologised for posting it. Georgie, we'll come to you first. You're a comedian. Should the RNIB be using their social media platforms to make a joke about sight loss?
Yeah, sure, why not? Why shouldn't the RNIB be able to make jokes about blind people? It was by no means a joke that was punching down. It was incredibly ironic, if anything. I liked that they made a joke about something that we can all relate to who are visually impaired and blind. It was, the joke was about knocking things over, walks into this, walks into that. But it was coming from the RNIB, a charity that represent people of visual impairment. So in that was funny. Then the actual joke is that they were taking ownership of that before sort of anyone else can, if that makes sense. By no means should they have deleted it or apologised. I appreciate sometimes things with comedy, it's subjective. There's a lot of comedians out there I don't like, so I don't watch their stuff. Now, I appreciate the RNIB is not a comedian or a comic platform. However, why can't they be? And if you don't like that joke, fine, don't have to like it. It wasn't aimed at everybody.
But
and that's your offence that I think you maybe need to... Sorry, carry on.
Sorry, is there an argument to be made, and this goes out to both of you, can we see why people would have been offended by the joke and put it to RNIB that they shouldn't be posting such things?
I can see why people would take offence to that joke like they might to hundreds of jokes out there. But that's down to the individual. If you don't like that joke, then fine. You don't have to like it. I don't think the RNIB should be completely neutral and not be able to make jokes. If anything, it was quite a clever sort of marketing ploy. It gave a whole sort of other way of approaching the RNIB. It's like this charity is actually quite down to earth, quite tongue in cheek. And it gave them a slightly different identity.
I'm with Georgie on this one. I would say, I mean, I thought it was more a play on words. It's something that I would have said about myself at some point. Although I do recognise the fact that some people are at different levels or different stages of a journey. So perhaps if you've just been diagnosed with sight loss and you are facing losing your sight, you might think this is not something to be joked about. So it's one of these very subjective things, I think. But it wasn't an offensive joke, though, I don't think.
Well, the RNIB did issue an apology, as Georgie said. Alongside the deleted tweet, they posted, "We understand that there are conflicting views on this issue. We agree that generally jokes can be made in bad taste. However, among the blind and partially sighted community, light-hearted self-deprecation is often commonplace, and we wanted to reflect this. We've now deleted the tweet and we apologise. It wasn't our intention to offend or distress anyone." Now, Simon, we know you're not one to back away from your convictions. Were the RNIB correct to have deleted the tweet based on only a few complaints?
Tricky one. Well, I think it shows a degree of humility and cognizance of people's feelings on that. I think the joke itself wasn't laughing at the disability. I think laughing at someone's disability is a different thing to laughing about things that can happen along the way. So I don't know whether that was the right thing to do, because by not doing it, perhaps it would put the back up of a lot of other people, and perhaps that's a negative response. So whether it's right or wrong, you don't want that negative response.
Georgie, I'm sure you've offended a few people in your career. Is it just about the delivery? Is there a way that the RNIB could have taken part in National Telejoke Day without offending anyone?
No, you can't. Every time that we tell a joke or we speak or we voice an opinion, somebody might be offended. That's life. That's the way that the world works. Everybody has different feelings on things. And I don't see that it's the RNIB's problem, for want of a better word, to make sure that nobody is offended in every action that they take. If we all went by that, nothing would get done. They should not have deleted the tweet. I like their statement, because in that statement, they actually defended themselves a bit there, and they should have gone that bit further and kept that up. The problem we have at the moment is when somebody is offended, they will go onto social media, they'll make a thing of it, and then whatever that thing they're offended by, we get rid of, we delete it, and that shuts down the discussion, the debate. And that's not what we should be doing. We should be talk as we are now, actually, taking it apart and saying, why were those people offended? How can we, you know, where around this, what can we learn from it? And what can those people learn from offence? And whereas offence, I don't think is the right word for this. I think it's more a dislike of the joke that they probably had. But we are in this offence culture at the moment, and people really, really want to be part of it. I don't know why at all.
It might be that offence is not the correct word, but part of the culture, as you're saying, Georgie. But the reason that the RNIB, I think, did take it down is because people specifically said that they were offended by it. Not that they disliked it, but that they were offended by it. And Simon, you were saying earlier that it wasn't a joke about blind people. Just to clarify, I know we've buried the lead a little bit here, but the joke went something along the lines of, a blind man walks into a bar, then walks into a chair, then spills a drink. Something along those lines. So people felt it was actually taking a direct shot at people with sight loss.
If I had said that about myself, you and I would have had a laugh about that. So I don't think the actual thing is offensive at all. Perhaps it's offensive for people who are in that position, who think that people with sight or full sight are just insensitive and don't care. But I think sometimes we just need to grow a sense of humour.
Is it because the RNIB did it in such a public platform? Is this what the RNIB Twitter feed should be used for?
Sure, why not? Why can't the RNIB have a sense of humour and try and put that? Because it's a great thing to have on Twitter. The RNIB want to boost their profile consistently. And a good way to do that is to show you've got a sense of humour, make people laugh, and then they might follow them. And then you've got something else there. So I'm sorry for people who don't have a sense of humour that were offended by it, but there are other aspects to the RNIB to get on board with. There's absolutely no reason why they couldn't be part of National Telejoke Day, because of the risk of offending a few. And the joke was, if anything, it's actually quite, there's something quite powerful about it, that because they have ownership of it, the RNIB, as I do when I make jokes about visual impairment. I have that visual impairment. I can tell this joke, and they should be really, really proud of that. And for anybody who wants to punch down and make jokes about disability with no knowledge or experience of it, it's sort of taken that away from them. Also gotten sort of a bit past some of the misconceptions of disability and visual impairments. Like, guess what? Visually impaired people have a sense of humour too.
Georgie, earlier this year, you ran the See the Funny Side project. You were the lead in the workshops for that, where a number of blind and partially sighted people took part to effectively become stand-up comedians. They put together 5-minute routines, a lot of which were, as you're saying there, It was comedy about the experiences and the things that have happened since they have lost their sight, or if they were born with sight loss, some of the experiences that they've gone through. Did you find that that was empowering?
Oh, God, yeah. And the things that those guys were coming out with, I mean, you if you're offended by the RNIB's joke, then definitely don't go see any of them. They were wonderful. They're absolute terrors. It was great. And they did something really, really bold by taking ownership of it. And, you know, we can have a sense of humour about this. And it's a shame, again, that they did delete the tweet, because maybe someone who is coming to terms with sight loss and is struggling, they could find light and humour in it. And they've taken that away, which is a real shame. And that's exactly what the guys with See the Funny Side were doing, and other comedians out there. There's some in Edinburgh at the moment who are doing exactly that. And it's a real shame, because it's incredibly, not just therapeutic, but it gives you a bit of identity and power again when you feel like you're losing it.
I spoke to Jamie McDonald, who is one of the comedians at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival just now.
I really like him.
Oh, he's great. But his act this year, and this is his sixth year of doing shows at the festival, and this one it's based around, again, aspects of visual impairment, and one of them is about the benefits. So it's the PIP fiasco. And it's sort of raising a joke about its points for benefits, like a really bad quiz show. And I think that kind of humour, which is laughing about the situation sometimes and the convoluted way we have to approach things, actually raises awareness to people who aren't involved in sight issues. Goodness me, I hadn't even thought about that. I didn't even know that was going on. So I think it's a positive thing.
Okay, this is one of those ones that I think is going to keep going round and round the roundabout, but we want you to get involved. If you have a thought on RNIB's position on their joke, whether they should have deleted it or not, do get in touch via our social media channels at RNIB Radio on Twitter. Find us on Facebook, RNIB Connect Radio, or email radio@rnib.org.uk. Okay, on to our next story, and this one has made news all over the world, as Apple is being sued due to their website not being accessible enough. Often hailed as a champion of accessibility, Apple are under fire after a blind user in New York visited the website earlier this month but encountered multiple access barriers that denied full and equal access to the facilities, goods and services offered to the public, such as being able to browse and purchase products, make service appointments, or learn of the facilities available in Apple stores in New York, the city where he is a resident. Simon, we'll start with you. Since Apple have championed accessibility for so long, will this be seen as biting the hand that feeds?
Well, I don't know, because obviously it's America and they're known to be very litigious over there. It seems to be the way you solve things. But from a personal point of view, I must admit, I groaned when I heard this, because I think there is a place for legal action, but there's also a place for discussion, and especially this particular company who have really championed accessibility and accessibility out of the box. So I don't know. I'm not saying that the chap doesn't have a point here, but perhaps we should maybe encourage rather than just go straight in and hit with a big stick.
As you say, it is a litigious society in New York. You and I were talking about this earlier. Was there room for the chap to get in touch with Apple? We know that they listen. They've listened to Stephen Scott on his Tech Talk show before. They've tried really hard with their accessibility in the past. Has he gone straight to the litigious element and try to make a buck, even though Apple are doing their best for the blind and partially sighted community?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the man's motives, to be honest. He might think that he's going to succeed in doing a groundbreaking decision that he's made that's going to change things, but suing them isn't going to change things. Changing things will change things. So I would have thought discussion about that, and then if that's not going to happen, it's only one person we're talking about here, aren't we? You know, so the headline can make it sound like everybody's suing Apple for this. It's one person.
The only problem is the one person can sometimes be the first domino to fall. Mm. And then people will see, depending on how successful his case is, whether or not. But again, we're falling into a territory that it could be that people have genuinely had issues with this. Mm-hmm. We don't know the full story yet. It is still developing. Georgie, Apple has prided itself on including accessibility features in its products. The company has also worked with other companies and organisations in producing accessibility aids, including the RNIB. Do you think this will have an impact on Apple being a product of choice among the blind and partially sighted community?
Probably, yes. I think there will be a knock-on effect for them. When I first read the story, I couldn't help but laugh that they are a company that is so forward-thinking, so innovative. I mean, the new Apple Watch will tell you when you need to put sunscreen on. That's the sort of technology that they're developing. There's another thing that does that. It's your skin will normally tell you, but people love these watches. And this sort of oversight of the website not being accessible, I just find hilarious that somebody didn't go, ah, we've missed a beat here. Not funny in a good way, but in a funny in a sort of, oh my God, how did they not sort this out sooner? However, yeah, one guy against a corporation like Apple, that's bold. I think it's a bit of a 0-60 move to go straight to suing. It's a discussion to have with them, see why the oversight happened and fix it.
Well, we know that Apple, with especially things like, as you're saying, Georgie, the Apple Watch, the iPhone, the iPad, Apple have been really, really aggressive almost about making their accessibility features the best on the market. Is there an argument to be made to say, why did they not do it with their main website? How is it possible that they've made such an oversight?
Oh, God knows. That's what should be happening, is there should be a discussion with the visually impaired community, a representative or a charity, with the guys at Apple, and saying, how did this happen? How can we fix it and get it done quickly? Apple have the money and the means to do this as well, so there is absolutely no excuse. Going down the suing them route, I think, is not the healthy way to go, because that's going to get them panicking, and it's also going up against Apple just seems like a mad idea anyway. It should be, let's get this fixed and let's learn from it and encourage companies like Apple to lead an example about accessibility. And I'm sorry, going back to your last question, I didn't really answer it. The knock-on effect that it could have their relationship with things like the RNIB and the visually impaired community. Yeah, it would be a problem, because if their stuff's not accessible, we ain't going to use it. So if they want to, you know, shut down that area of the market, which they definitely won't want to do because they could lose money, then they will fix this quickly.
Well, surely that's it as well, because as much as we like to think of altruism, money talks. So, you know, if this is going to reflect on their market and a section of the market negatively, then they will want to fix that. That is business. So
yeah, they are the monopoly, and they want to stay the monopoly. And also the problem, if people want to use other techs that are accessible, there ain't a lot of companies that are as innovative as Apple.
Okay, let's get back into it, shall we? So reportedly, this year's Edinburgh Fringe Festival is still only around 50% accessible. Georgie, you recently took part in a gig to support more accessibility at this world-famous event. Why is it still such a problem?
I was chatting with my mate last night, and there's a couple of things got to take into account with the Edinburgh Fringe. It's huge, it's not curated, and Edinburgh is one of the most inaccessible cities just because of the way it's made. A lot of the venues that do house the shows, some are listed, some you just cannot adapt. So we're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place with accessibility there. However, what can be brought in is attempts to try and see if those things can be done. Obviously, that costs money. But again, it's a marketing thing. If the venue see it as, if we make this change at the venue, that will get more people in and thus more money made in the long run. Things like audio description, BSL interpretation, captioning. I mean, captioning can be done very, very cheaply. A lot of these things, there are ways around it, as I found with the last play that I did. Approaching venues and giving them the knowledge and ways around it is sort of the best thing we can do. How it's still this way is almost a bit like Apple. It's another oversight. It's another thing that's gotten missed, probably because not enough noise has been made about it. Thankfully, yeah, I did the accessibility gala at the Pleasance in Edinburgh this month, and it was Josh Heppel who organised it, and a bit of, you know, a fuss has been made, and hopefully things will change for next year.
Well, as Georgie points out there, Simon, should we just accept that this is as good as it gets? The festival tries to use many weird and random venues. Can we really make them all accessible?
I think that is one of the problems, adding to what Georgie was saying. A lot of the venues are very old and very inaccessible. And perhaps, you know, by the nature of even stand-up, perhaps it's a room that's rented above a pub that's never used for this sort of thing. So I think it's more, let's think, jar half full. We're 50% there. So, you know, how do we educate people and people who are putting on events to think about this? Because I think from putting on an event, Georgie's done it with captioning, but it's a lot to take on. You know, if you've ever organised a gig There's a lot to go on there. It just has to become part of the thinking when you're organising a gig, making it accessible. But how we do that, I don't know. We have to keep on doing what we're doing. But again, I think just hitting people with a stick isn't necessarily the way to do it. If you make people actually understand, you know, the market and how people are getting so much more out of it, and next year you'll have more people come back, then that works from a business point of view.
Yeah, I think there's two options that are worth considering is making sure that there is a board of some sort that deals with access, that can have a conversation with the venues and, you know, knowledge is power, basically. Educate them, as you said, Simon, on the changes that they can make as cheaply as they can within the means of the building and see the long-term effects. Secondly, as well, is it was just mentioned this at the gala. The Edinburgh Fringe have their main website, their main hub. It does have a guidelines of what venues need to be and do to become an Edinburgh Fringe venue. What I would say to do is to change those guidelines and just enforce them a bit more. At the moment, it says strive to be as accessible as possible. I would be firmer with that and say try harder to do all of these things as best as you can and then go from there. Otherwise, you can't be an Edinburgh Fringe venue. And trust me, they will try those venues because they can make a hell of a lot of money up there.
Georgia, you've... You do live gigs, live events. I do them. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but taking out of the accessibility point of view, some things that venues get away with, I get quite surprised at, that I think are dangerous even just for able-bodied people. You think, I didn't think that was allowed anymore. You know, an access here or a blocked access or a very bad step in bad lighting or no lighting. So it's not just about accessibility. I think the pressure has to be put on generally.
Yeah, on everyone's health and safety. It needs to be reevaluated, especially in the Edinburgh venues. Some of them are an absolute death trap, whether you've got, you know, two eyes or no eyes. And yeah, comedy venues are the same. Basic things, mind the step, you know, put better lighting as well. This whole sort of mood and atmosphere lighting, it's just no good.
But it's that same old thing, isn't it? Is your venue accessible? Yes, we have braille dots below the light switches, and we have signs to say that they mind your head. Now, I think if I can find a group of dots underneath a light switch, I can find the light switch. So, you know, I think people's view of what makes something accessible is something that needs to be looked at as well.
A lot of them are very, very simple changes as well. It's not going to cost a lot of money or a lot of time either. And yet, if you approach with a business... the business effects of the long term, then everyone's a winner.
Money talks.
Now, I understand that the Fringe itself hosts thousands upon thousands of shows, and not every single performer or director is going to do this. But Georgie, you were recently in a show called Libby's Eyes, and the audio description was actually considered at the same point of the inception of the script. Is there room for more people to do shows like this?
Absolutely. It's an option. That's what Amy, the writer, and Spencer, the director, sort of put out to the world, saying you can do this and it can be a part of the play and actually give it another dynamic and make it a better show. However, I appreciate, because I write my own work and I write solo shows, sometimes it doesn't work artistically, but maybe that's something worth playing with and a whole new sort of genre to explore within theatre. And it's also a cheap, easy way to get audio description in.
And Simon, you're a performer yourself. Is there more that performers can be doing? This goes out to you as well, of course, Georgie, to ensure that venues start trying harder to make things accessible. Would it do any good for performers to say, look, this is not an accessible place for a blind or partially sighted person or a deaf person or someone with a wheelchair? I'm not going to perform.
I think that's can be a negative way to go down because... again, money talks. I'm sorry to talk this way, but to a venue and you say, well, how many blind or partially sighted people have you had over the year? They might not even be aware of having any. So they might say, well, OK, don't come. You know, it doesn't make any difference to us. So I don't think perhaps that is the way to approach it, to be honest. I think, like Georgie says, I think there has to be a much more overall approach to this, that it's more like the Equalities Act. It's not a matter of if you can, it would be good. It's like you need to. It's the law.
In terms of like comedy gigs, one, tell the venues and the promoters, but I'm realised people will be reticent about that because spots are so precious, it is quite competitive there. And in case they do have a sort of adverse reaction to you kicking off. So yeah, I'd be sneaky about it, to be honest. I'd say if you consider doing these things, I can get a group of visually impaired people down, sell a bunch of tickets, and we're all winning. If you just make these simple changes, I'll help improve your business.
Do you think we could do the, you know, like the Dinner in the Dark, where we turned everything round? Could we do shows like that where we make it totally inaccessible for sighted people, but for our world we can get around and it's fine, and it's just like welcome to our world.
Yeah, taste your own medicine. It's bitter.
It would certainly be a show to remember. Okay, guys, a lot to consider there, and we want you to join the conversation and let us know your thoughts on these stories. Tweet us at RNIB Radio. Contact us via Facebook, RNIB Connect Radio. Or you can email radio@rnib.org.uk. Georgie, you have a gig coming up. Tell us about it.
I do indeed. I'm in at Carlisle Fringe this Friday, 10 o'clock, at the Container Theatre, doing my debut four-star show, A Poke in the Eye.
Sounds fantastic. Simon, you're on the Afternoon Edition every weekday at 3 o'clock. Georgie Morrell and Simon Polly, thank you so much for joining me on the Daily Connect today.
You're very welcome. Enjoyed it.
No, pleasure. Thank you. The Daily Connect
podcast. Time now to find out about our Society of the Week. The Beacon Centre in the Black Country offer a huge variety of services. Yvonne Walker is a service user who has benefited from the Beacon Centre, and Helen Brown is the Communications Development Manager. We'll hear from them both now and find out why the Beacon Centre is so important to people with sight loss in the Black Country.
My name's Helen Brown. I'm the Communications Development Manager at the Beacon Centre. We work with people with sight loss across the Black Country. I've worked here for about a year and a half.
My name's Yvonne Walker and I'm a service user at the Beacon Centre in Wolverhampton. I had a brain tumour called a meningioma and it was sitting above the optic nerves because I had to have a craniotomy, so it actually destroyed the optic nerves. Got my sight back for 4 days and then lost it again because the optic nerves had a stroke. Lost the sight overnight. You just got to get on with it. And I'd got two young daughters, so you just got to get on with life. And the Beacon Centre have helped me do that.
We offer a huge variety of services. We've got lots of day activities, things like cooking classes, social activities, pottery sessions. We do tailored health, so gym sessions based around things like fall prevention, painting, knitting. We have a low vision advice service. We have the UK's first accredited social enterprise opticians, which helps fund some of the work that we do. We have a second centre in Stourbridge where they also run an array of day activities. We have a hugely successful employment programme. We also have a very active activity group called Active Eyes who go out and do all sorts of things like climbing, rowing, walking, running. And we have a youth club as well.
Social services were in touch with me and trying to do rehab, learning with the white long cane and some cookery skills again, and they brought me on a visit to the Beacon Centre and asked me if I would like to, you know, would it be something I would be wanting to do. So I came on a visit and it was good because we got the carpentry, we got cooking classes, we got the craft classes, computers. So everything has altered over the years, obviously, but I thought, well, yeah, I'll come and have a go. So I started off doing crafts and some computer lessons, and that's how I've gone on over the years, still doing crafts, cookery. I've also done with the Active Eyes as well, so I've learnt different things. I've done water skiing, I've climbed gladiator wall, I've done loads of different things. You've got to push yourself and keep proving that blind people can do.
I really enjoy seeing the pottery that people do because it's absolutely fantastic. Some of it's often sold to raise funds for the work we do at the centre. I have a beautiful shell in my bathroom that everybody comments on when they come in, and it's just stunning to see what can be achieved. We very much want to be needed, not needy. So one of the things we have is our social enterprise opticians, which we hope that as well as raising funds helps raise awareness about the importance of eyesight. And you know, we're always looking to do new and innovative fundraising things like that wherever we can. We've got around just under 200 volunteers and just under 100 members of staff. And we could help kind of anywhere up to 3,000 people a year. So one of our particular specialisms is technology, and we are constantly looking to see where we can use technology to help improve the lives of people with sight loss.
Since I came here, I didn't realise I'd got a creative bone in my body. But with craft work, I've push myself. I do sewing and knitting, and over the years I've made some very weird and wonderful stuff. I've made a scarecrow, which won an award at a craft fair, so I'm quite chuffed with myself. Sally and Ellie, who run the classes, they cut them out for us and they pin them, and we follow the pins with our needles, and we've got what we call a self-threading needle, so we can actually thread our needles ourselves. It's got a very little slight slit in the eye of the needle, and we can thread the cotton through and we can sew away to our heart's content. We don't need to ask anybody to thread a needle for us. And then when you run out of pins, they'll pin the next lot for you, and then we put it all together, or whatever you've got to do with it. I've also started in the life skills kitchen, so I'm relearning stuff, and I'm actually learning how to do other stuff I've wanted to have a go at. And today we've just been making fish pie. The other week we did samosas. We've done the Christmas cake. You know, it's just relearning and giving you the confidence to have a go at different things. And I have made some of the things that we've made in the life skills kitchen. I've done it at home on my own, and it's given me the confidence to do it. I mean, I also do computers, so I'm actually learning on an iPad at the moment. So everything nowadays is going to iPads and Androids and everything. So it gives us the chance to learn all the gestures. Then I can actually talk to my children now, and they know what I'm on about, and I know what they're on about. So it's actually given me a bridge so I can understand what they're on about now.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
This year marks RNIB's 150th anniversary. To celebrate, we've been asking the blind and partially sighted community for their stories and experiences of sight loss. We'll be sharing these stories over the coming months to document the changes we've seen in the last 150 years. Today, it's the turn of Hussein Patwa, who says, "Childhood was a lonely time for me. Sight loss was tolerated but not accepted, acknowledged but not understood. I remember often wondering why I was just a little bit different, why I never quite seemed to enjoy the same spark of fun and satisfaction as my classmates. Since discovering RNIB aged 12, I realised there was a place for me in this world, that I could make something of myself and that I had real friends. I discovered Haggai, and through that, opportunities to volunteer and develop myself and the confidence to study and gain a job. Through RNIB and stories like this, I dream of a future where disability will be as much a part of society as race or gender are, and where, thanks to technology, equality will be an as-is rather than an aspiration. RNIB motivated me to make something of myself. I hope listening to this will do that for you too." If you're interested in sharing your story, please complete the submission form at rnib.org.uk/150stories.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
RNIB's How I See campaign is a really innovative way of helping us all better understand vision loss. Lots of you have been sharing your stories on YouTube, Facebook and Twitter, and of course, right here on RNIB Connect Radio. Here, Rachel has some interesting thoughts about her sight condition, retinitis pigmentosa.
So my sight condition is retinitis pigmentosa, which is one of the retinal dystrophies. It means that kind of slowly the retina sort of dies off, stops working. And there are various kind of forms of it, but mine presented, which is a quite common presentation, with early night blindness, inability to function in low and dark kind of light levels, and then the gradual erosion of my peripheral vision, leaving me with a little patch of kind of tunnel vision, I suppose you'd call it, at this point in time. I think my sight is around 20 degrees at the moment, and is very likely to get a lot worse from there. In all sorts of ways, you know, trying to run after two very small children who are always out of my central vision is quite hard, often standing and calling for my child, and I then find out he's standing directly in front of me. And so taking a long time to get out of the house, finding it quite hard to go places with them unless it's really obvious that they are contained. I find it difficult to run after them, to locate them if they were, you know, kind of off just playing in a kind of open area. I find that when I'm wheeling a pram, it's not very easy to use a cane, so I'm quite reliant on, you know, going quite slowly with the pram and kind of feeling my way. I'm also aware of the amount of confusion that it causes when I got my children at nursery using a pram and then, you know, come back using my cane, and people are probably thinking, you know, what on earth is that lady doing? But generally, just having to take a bit longer to do things, finding it quite emotionally difficult and stressful, and just kind of an added layer really on most things. Yeah, it is. And there are two kind of types, I suppose. There's friends that I've had a chance to explain to, and the most of them are fine with it, but sometimes they'll see me with a pram and they'll come up to me and say, oh, you're cured then? And I'll say, well, no one's come up with a cure as yet, because they're confused by, you know, well, where's your cane gone? And then you've got, you know, strangers who might, some people that might see me quite regularly, people that work locally, and I walk past them, and I've had some comments from them, people shouting and coming up to me and kind of challenging me, you know, what can you see? I thought you were blind. And so a bit of that going on, which can be very unsettling. Yeah, I think the casual friends and people that, you know, see me all the time but don't know me, I think they are probably the people that take up most of my headspace. And what I try and do is, you know, put it as far to the back of my mind as I can. But I suppose there's always a part of me that's thinking, you know, if I go on this route, who am I likely to see? What am I taking my cane? Am I using my cane consistently? Or are there times when I'm going to have to run after my children? So I'll suddenly go from a cane user to a, you know, fundamentally what looks like a sighted, although rather bumbling, sighted person. Am I going into the centre of town, in which case I'm going to need the cane absolutely, or am I in the quieter outskirts, in which case I can do without it? What messages do those send? Should I be completely honest about if someone, you know, points out to me something? Should I just take the help even if I don't need it? All these things just constantly kind of go round and round in my head, and I'm kind of trying really hard to just let them be and notice them and let them go. But it is an extra layer of energy and questioning of myself and others that I'm aware goes on. Oh, I was so pleased to be contacted about that film, because it feels as if there's not much out there for people like me who are partially, well, in some lights are partially sighted and other lights are completely blind. So it feels like to be able to talk about my experiences and be valued and heard, and to be able to communicate what's happening for me and to hear other stories. You know, I've got an idea about what living with other sight conditions might be, but I can't really know. And so it was just really wonderful. And I hope that it will allow people who don't know anything about these sight conditions to maybe just take a pause and just ask, do you need any help? You know, that's all we're asking for, and to give us the benefit of the doubt. I doubt there's anyone that goes around using a cane or a dog that is, you know, is doing it just for a bit of fun. You know, it's a big change to your life. It's a massive shift. And I think if this film can get across just how complex some of the challenges are for people, I think it's a wonderful thing. Oh gosh, it's been absolutely both ends of the scale and everything in between. I think that on balance, it's definitely forced me to consider, I suppose, what it is to be human, what it is to, you know, we will all hopefully grow old, and we will all encounter illness and potentially disability in our lives. You know, the older that we get, it's caused me to think really carefully about what's important in life, who I want to be as a person, what kind of values I want to live by. And I think, you know, even if those things have come around naturally, I think certainly having retinitis pigmentosa has forced those questions earlier and led me to a greater clarity. So although it does have a lot of difficulties, and, you know, the thought that I might not see my children grow up is, you know, heartbreaking, but at the same time, I am aware of how it has sharpened the value that I place in life as well.
Rachel talking there about the impact of her sight condition, retinitis pigmentosa.
The Daily Connect podcast.
And that's it for another edition of the Daily Connect podcast. There will be a brand new show with you tomorrow just after 5 p.m. And indeed, every weekday after 5 p.m, get a brand new episode of the Daily Connect podcast. As for tomorrow's show, well, we have a takeover taking place. The girls from the podcast Suddenly Sightless, Alexandra and Laura, will be taking over the reins of the show and adding some much-needed female voices to the Daily Connect. We will also have Alan Russell with us to tell us a little bit about what he's excited for coming up this weekend. And community facilitator Nikki Kelly will be telling us what's happening in the West Midlands, as well as taking us to the Working Age Forum. So that's a Daily Connect podcast tomorrow. Get in touch with us. We want your voice on the Daily Connect. You can tweet us at RNIB Radio. Search for RNIB Connect Radio on Facebook or email radio@rnib.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
The Daily Connect Podcast.